Okay. Everyone, welcome to this week's edition of Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, coming to you live once again from Rochester, New York. Thanks for joining me today on Paranormal Radio Network. And if you didn't know this yet, you can also hear us now on UPRN 105.8 FM in New Orleans. I'm still really excited about that. Or also on your cell phone by typing P-A-R-A, then 27627. And I am completely not a techno geek. I'm like still stuck in the last century. I don't understand how this whole cell phone thing works, but it sounds pretty cool to me. I'm going to have to try one of these days on my cell phone. As always, everyone, I want to hear from you during the show. If you're listening live, join us on the message board in Pell Talk to discuss the program and add your questions and comments. Go to ParanormalRadioNetwork.com to join us in the virtual auditorium. You can participate in the conversation through instant messaging. You can also email me anytime with your questions and comments. My email address is kdolan@rochester.rr.com. Or if you don't want to do either of those, you can call into the show the old-fashioned way by telephone, toll-free at 1-877-786-0562. I just want to mention before we get started that this weekend, the Mutual UFO Network is holding their 39th annual International Symposium in San Jose, California. If you've never been to one of these, I strongly encourage you to do so. I have been to the last few years, and they're always amazing. The MUFON organization always tries to approach their work in the most scientific way possible. And these conferences are always very seriously handled and very informative, which does not mean they're not fun. They're great. This year's speakers are, it's a wide range of speakers from many different countries. We have Nick Pope from Great Britain, Farah Yerdozu, who's from Turkey. She lives in the United States now. Don Ledger, Larry Lemke, Dr. Anthony Choi, General Wilfred de Brouwer, Leslie Keene, Dr. Richard Haynes, Ted Rowe, Geronimo Flores, and Victor Camacho. They'll be presenting evidence of UFO sightings and ongoing investigations from as many as 8 different countries. Journalist George Knapp will also be there to discuss the events at the Skinwalker Ranch in Utah. And if you haven't heard about that yet, get hold of his book that he wrote with Colm Kelleher called Hunt for the Skinwalker. It's pretty amazing stuff. And for those of you radio fans who are also fans of the Black Vault radio program, John Greenwald will be there as Master of Ceremonies for the MUFON conference. I highly, highly recommend that you go. It's already sort of underway. The speakers begin tomorrow morning, but if you're in the area and you get a chance to get over there, do it. If you want to find out more about it, go to www.mufon.com. If you can't get there this year, go to their website and see about getting hold of some DVDs of the presentations. It really promises to be a fantastic conference. Now, getting on to the show this evening, my guest today is Elizabeth Egan Cox. I'm doing something a little different today. This is the first time I've actually interviewed a novelist, and this is pretty cool. She just wrote a book called A Ghost of a Chance, which is a paranormal novel. It's actually going to be released next week, but she very kindly let me have a copy to look at before, and I loved it. Elizabeth, can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can. And
great.
Actually, I heard from my publisher today that they did an early release at
OBPocket.com,
since this is an electronic book. And so,
I'm sorry, what is that website again? I want to put that out.
The website is www.mobipocket.com.
M-O-D-I.
Pocket. M-O-B as in boy.
Okay. I didn't think I was hearing it right.
Mobi,
M-O-B-I,
like
Pocket.
Yeah, mobipocket.com.
Oh.
Anyone familiar with e-books and retailers of e-books will know what mobipocket.com is. She was just so excited that I was going to do this interview. She said, well, we've got to get it out there somewhere. It won't be on the publisher's website until August 1st, and then a few weeks after that, it'll show up on Amazon.com and FictionWise and all of the regular retailers. So I really appreciate, you know, you having me on, and I didn't realize that I was your first novelist.
You are my first novelist on here. I've had a couple people who've written books, but they've always been these, you know, very serious books about people's research in ufology or paranormal. So this is, I'm kind of heading in a new direction here, and this is really fun.
Well, thank you. And you know, touching on the base of it being called paranormal, when I first wrote this, I have always referred to it as a ghost story. And in shopping around for publishers, I had a hard time trying to figure out what genre this is. It certainly is a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's classified as a mystery first, but then it cross-references into what I refer to as an old-fashioned ghost story, and I would try to explain to people as old as myself who could remember The Ghost and Mrs. Mirror, the old TV show, or could relate to the modern TV show, The Ghost Whisperer, that it would be along those lines. And a friend of mine who is also a lit agent said, well, Elizabeth, what you have is a paranormal mystery. And that was sort of a light bulb moment for me, because paranormal to me is sort of a description that has just kind of come about in the last, I don't know, maybe decade, or at least it's just kind of gone mainstream. And
it's true. It's really,
yeah,
it's everywhere right now.
It is everywhere. And you know, in looking at, so being a former librarian, I immediately went into the web and did deep research, and I discovered that paranormal is a very, very broad umbrella. Once upon a time, the way the word mystery was for the fiction genre.
Mm-hmm.
And now today, you know, mystery has many subcategories, like your hard-boiled mystery or your true crime mystery. And now it has the category of a paranormal mystery.
And well, if you say mystery referring to a book, it seems to me that means there's a murder in it. I mean,
yes,
it's not
no.
just a puzzle. It's,
yes.
There has to be a death, and there has to be an unnatural death, and the puzzle is going to be that you figure out who did it.
Exactly.
There are so many other mysteries out there.
Yeah. And then the other aspect that this particular novel of mine fits into is that it is a cozy mystery. Now, that subcategory of cozy has been around since Agatha Christie. She is the queen of cozies.
Oh, I'm a huge fan of Agatha Christie.
Okay. Here's the difference. If a mystery is going to be a cozy mystery, it means that 99% of the time, the person who turns out to be the hero or the lead character discovers that whatever usually it's a murder, so I'll use the word murder, discovers that the murder has already happened. Whereas in other types of category of mystery, the murder happens during the storyline.
Oh,
but in a cozy,
point.
It has already happened, whether it's a murder, a robbery, or whatever it is that needs to be solved. And the discovery is that the lead character discovers that this happened and then goes about solving it. And now the other aspect of it being a cozy mystery is that we often call this a Reader's Digest level of a mystery, meaning that if you're reading it, you can leave it up on your screen or you can leave the book open, and you don't have to worry if a child picks it up.
Yeah. Well, I have two children, so I appreciated that, because I did read most of it online.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, I'm kind of thrilled that it's sort of cross-referenced into the cozy aspect of a mystery, because that's, I really meant it to be at that level. And then the paranormal aspect, because the paranormal aspect, unbeknownst to me when I wrote this, is becoming mainstream. And I think that says a lot about the progress of society in general.
I'm just fascinated with the idea. When I saw your description of the book as a cozy mystery, I was thinking like someone refers to a book as like a good beach read or a nice summer read or
mm-hmm.
And I get this image of like curling up by the fireplace with this great little book. You know, it's just a nice evening. It was a fairly quick read. It was really fun, a lot of fun. And I think it's so cool that the word cozy is actually a genre.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a recognized term in literary circles.
Oh,
see, I read all the time, but I don't talk to people about literature.
Yeah. Yeah, cozy, in North America, it's referred to as a cozy mystery. Over in the UK and Western Europe, they often call it a teacup mystery. And I discovered from my Irish cousins who live in Australia that they also use the term teacup mystery.
That sounds very Agatha Christie.
Doesn't that sound?
Yeah.
Of course, here in America, we drink more coffee than we do tea.
Yeah. Well, I'm an inveterate tea drinker, too, though.
Oh, are you? I tried to be. It's a hard habit for me to break because I love coffee. I even drink iced coffee. And I got into that habit when I visited New Orleans, which is one of my favorite cities. I have never
living
been
in
to
the
New
South
York.
Will open you up to all kinds of cold drinks, I would think.
Yes. Even if you're there over Halloween.
Yeah, I can imagine. See, I'm in upstate New York, way, way, way up north.
Like by Buffalo?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, about an hour from Buffalo.
Yeah, okay.
We're right on Lake Ontario, right on the northern border. I mean, I take my kids to the beach at Lake Ontario and say, you know, you look out over the water and you can't see land on the other side.
The Great Lakes are really big.
But on the other side is Canada.
Yes. So. I was born in Michigan.
Oh, well, so I don't have to explain the Great Lakes to you.
No, but...
But I did once have to explain where Rochester is to my in-laws, who are all on Long Island.
Oh my gosh.
And so when I said to them, we live in upstate New York, they said, oh, Poughkeepsie? And I said, no, farther. And we spent about 10 minutes, they're saying, I don't know, Ronkonkoma? I said, no, farther than that. And finally I said, look, it takes us 7-8 hours to drive here from Rochester. It takes us about an hour and a half to get to Canada.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now we got it.
Well, I was born in Michigan, but we moved out to California, where my relatives already were, when I was between kindergarten and first grade. So I actually consider myself more of a California person.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely,
but I do,
for that young.
Yeah, I do remember Michigan, and I remember Canada because we used to go across the Great Lakes to Canada to a place called Boblo Island.
Mm.
And it was a huge amusement park island. And we went across there so often, I did not know the difference between Canada and America. And I think that happens to a lot of people who live close to a border country.
Yeah. I remember going to the Canadian side of Niagara Falls quite a lot when I was a kid. You know, we would drive to Buffalo and then take the bridge across there.
And did you notice much difference?
It's beautiful in Canada. My sister and I, even when we were little, we'd say, oh, we must be in Canada. If we'd been dozing off in the back seat, we'd say, oh, we're here because there's no litter on the ground and the flowers are all blooming.
Okay.
And it's so pretty. Yeah. We must be over there.
That can certainly be a problem. We travel throughout the southern states because all my ancestry is southern. It really was just by happenstance that I was born in Michigan. Long story that I won't go into, but my...
Well, did your parents travel a lot for their jobs? Was it, or were they in the military?
Actually, my father was born in 1905, and he was in the Merchant Marines, and then he was in the Merchant Marines again during World War II when he joined at that time to volunteer. My father traveled a lot. He was a world-class chef. And I traveled some with him, mostly to the Caribbean. My brother traveled a little bit more. He traveled to Asia and Europe. But I lost my father when I was 14.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And he was a huge influence on my life. My Eden is my maiden name. And if you read anything about my bio, you know that I'm a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution. So genealogy and history is something that I'm passionate about. But my Egan side is my great-grandfather who came here from Ireland in the 1840s. And to honor that side of my family, I fly the Irish flag right alongside my colonial Betsy Ross flag.
Oh, wow.
And to me, that part of my genealogy, now my great-grandfather who came here in the 1840s married into one of the oldest families in America out of Virginia, who have been here since the 1600s, and they were actually listed on the roster of America's first families. And they were all Southerners. And when my great-grandfather came here, he went into Kentucky.
Oh.
And we're part of the Kentucky family that consider us Southerners. You know, it kind of depends on where you live in Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
But because he married into Virginians, they were Southerners. And then on my mother's side, we were Irish as well. And they were out of Texas and Tennessee, and before that, in the Carolinas. So I have Revolutionary War patriots out of Virginia and both of the Carolinas. And so when we travel, I go to visit my ancestors. And wherever I travel below the Mason-Dixon line, there are skeletons rattling around just, you know, waiting to say hello. And so I think that sense of kind of traveling for grasping a sense of the past, you know, has influenced my writing a great deal in the spirituality of having to touch the path through, well, now what they're calling it a paranormal experience. It's what I would call a spirit visitation, or in American culture, a ghost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking when I read your bio and you mentioned the Irish clan, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. How do you pronounce the clan name?
Okay, that is the authentic spelling of the name, MacEgan.
So it's just pronounced Egan. I love Gaelic.
Yeah.
And because for listeners who don't see this on my website,
mm-hmm.
It's the clan Mac, M-A-C, which means son of or daughter of, right?
Yes.
And then Egan in Gaelic is spelled A-O-D-H-A-G-A-I-N.
Yes.
I love this. This is why I've tried to learn Gaelic so many times and I just haven't gotten it yet.
Oh, okay. Well, you're ahead of me. My father spoke Gaelic. And I tried to learn it too, but I do not have an ear. I'm tone deaf to begin with.
Oh.
And I think being tone deaf, first of all, I don't sing. And second of all, I think it's very difficult to learn a language if you're tone deaf. Because you can't get
yeah.
the intonation.
Well, the rules are completely different from English.
Oh, completely different. You know, it's actually considered the Celtic race, as some people might call it, and Celtic meaning Irish, Scottish, Welsh, predominantly Irish, Scottish, Welsh, is considered a race unto itself because its language, the Gaelic language, has no other root base to compare it to except its own. And I always thought that was very interesting. And years and years and years ago, I read this wonderful book called The Story of the Irish Race by Seamus. I can't remember his last name.
That title sounds familiar. I can't think of the author's name either, but
yeah,
I'm sure I've heard of that.
His first name is Seamus, which is James, by the way. And I think it's McManus. It might be Seamus McManus.
Okay.
And he just goes into great detail and depth about the history and the archaeological studies and, you know, and I grew up very much into the Irish culture. And I grew up knowing the different kinds of Irish people.
Now, see, I never got to that point, but my family's Scottish.
Okay,
both
well,
my
no,
parents
I,
are
I
Scottish.
Actually have Scottish, but my Scottish goes way back to colonial times, and I haven't been able to trace much of that, you know. And you know what? I was going to ask you about that, because on your website, besides the fact that I'm presuming that the photo of the red-haired lady is you.
That's me.
Okay, and you look remarkably like Bonnie Raitt.
Oh, really? Wow, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think she's so cool. I love her.
And even my husband thought so. And
oh, wow.
And,
I'm hoping one day I get that white streak like she has. I think it's so cool.
Well, okay, you look like you could be her younger sister.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
And I'm working on the second book in this series. And in it, I talk about some of the Scottish, because there's a Scottish character in the next book named Shelley McArdle. I was going to give her the name Shelley McCaskew, because that's one of my Scottish names, but I decided to go with McArdle, because I liked the sound of it. And I had just done this study on the genetics of how 40% of have the red hair gene, more so than any other ethnic culture in the world.
Wow.
And, you know, and then up pops your website, and you've got this red hair. And I told Christopher, I said, she could be Shelley McArdle in my next book.
Cool.
But anyway.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading that one.
Thank you. Right now, the working title for the next book is simply Shadow. And as with this book, the working title was simply Ghost. I actually have a couple of different phrases in mind for the title, but they all have the word shadow in them. So I'll kind of wait until the end and decide what the actual title will be.
So about how, I mean, I realize you can't really give me a definite answer right now, but roughly how long does it take you to write one of these books?
Well, technically, in this industry, and I am an author of other books, but they were nonfiction books, and they were written in coordination with this company that did corporate histories and regional histories. Those are the big hardback coffee table kinds of books. So I don't usually refer to it because that was more of a staff project kind of thing, even though my name is on the masthead. But technically, in this business, once you sign the contract for one book, and I signed the contract for Ghost of a Chance on April 23rd of this year, you should start writing the next book so that you have a book coming out once a year. Mm. Now, that's just sort of a general rule of thumb.
Okay.
But I've never known anyone to deny it or correct it.
Okay. Well, see, my husband is an author, but he doesn't write fiction.
Uh-huh.
He writes nonfiction, and his first book was 500-page history of UFOs and government response to UFO
mm-hmm.
reports over a period of, you know, many years. And he spent years doing the research and years
yeah.
writing it. And
yeah.
he's doing his second book now, and it's 8 years later, you know, because it's a huge job. And
well,
so I was trying to get an idea of what, I mean, you just talked about it like, oh, here, this book out, and I've got another one coming out soon, and I thought, oh, my gosh, like, in less than 5 years, this is pretty cool.
Well, and it's different with fiction.
Yeah.
And especially since this is a series, it's going to be a little bit different. But I know what you're talking about with nonfiction books, because there's so many T's to cross and I's to dot and a lot
mm-hmm.
of fact-checking and, you know, probably an index and a bibliography. A nonfiction book takes much longer because it is nonfiction. It's based
right.
on factual research as opposed to fiction. Now, I base a lot of my fiction, this book in particular, on a lot of factual research because I used to write, I'm known as a California historian, and I used to write for the Old California Gazette, and it was about California history. And so I like to kind of include those little tidbits of actual pieces of the past in a, you know, in part of the story to kind of help bring it, make it pop, so to speak. But yeah, nonfiction is kind of like writing an ongoing college thesis, and you're in that last semester of college for 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, you know, any other way to explain it, but
yeah.
because I have worked on nonfiction books as a project for a publisher. So, you know, my hats are off to people who write nonfiction. You know, those are the books that we go to. We need to, you know, to really do some research. And I can say that not only as a writer who researches voraciously, but I was a former school librarian. And, you know, where would libraries be today and schools be today without nonfiction? You know, and along those lines, librarians today, especially in schools, are kind of opening up and allowing books on the shelves that, and I don't necessarily mean allowing because of a lot of what is purchased for a library has to go strictly by a code of that school district, and then at county level, and then at state level, and to some degree at federal level. But I can remember when I was a school librarian, and I would kind of look for books that were coming out by independent publishers just to add a little bit different kind of category for my students to pick up on and be a little bit more open to.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the parents were really good about it, you know. I never had a problem with it, but I think that kind of differs from library to library.
Do you think that's changing over time? Do you think schools are more likely to block certain books now than they used to be?
I think it depends a lot. Okay, I'm in Southern California, and I live in San Bernardino County, which is the largest county in the United States. And I worked at three different schools within San Bernardino County. At grammar school, I would say that the parents really don't have much input on it because they're too busy with PTA.
Okay.
And at grammar school, librarians, and grammar school I mean K through 5 or K through 6, librarians are working on such a strict budget to try and coordinate bringing in the books that they need to meet the extracurricular needs of the various courses that are being taught at, you know, all different grade levels. And so librarians may not have as much choice. But I was at what we would call junior high level or middle school level, and I had a great range of choice because I needed to have books that were really kind of at fourth and fifth grade level, and then I needed to have books that were at high school level so that kids coming in could relate to books because they had already read them, and then they could also read books that would help them move into high school. I had a huge budget, but I also volunteered my time to serve on the school site council. That's a three-word title that is critical to all librarians in California, because if you can volunteer your time to serve on the school site council, you have input on how California lottery money that is given to the schools is spent.
Oh.
And a lot of it can go to the library. When I volunteered to be on the school site council, I insisted that we hold the meetings in the library so that I could show the parents, you know, the disrepair of the books. I could have publishers' catalogs open, or I could have letters of brochures that I had received advertising particular kinds of books out on the tables so that the parents could understand the variety of what's out there. I would get books on everything from, oh, I don't know, everything from, you know, different kinds of athletes and sports to all the traditional stuff you expect to find in a library. For the kids, because they were going to go into high school, I ordered books that I thought they would enjoy, and a lot of it was Stephen King. You know,
that's
and
interesting,
I know that,
because I was just thinking of asking you about, say, books on the paranormal. You know, if you had any problem, if you ran into any trouble from the parents with that. And Stephen King especially, I used to be a huge Stephen King fan.
Oh, yes.
And I read a lot of his early books. And aside from the paranormal aspect, I could see a lot of parents getting upset about that because of the violence and the language.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did parents object to the Stephen King books?
They did not object to the Stephen
King.
Wow,
that's great.
The one that they objected to was a really popular paperback series, and I can't remember the name of it now, but it was like Creepers or something like that. That was the one that they objected to. They didn't object to the fiction books about the characters that morphed into animals. They didn't object to...
Oh, just called animorphs, aren't they?
Yeah, something like that. They didn't object to...
I think I've seen those. I never read those, but I think I've seen them at libraries.
Yeah. They didn't object to, like the Narnia books.
Okay.
I forget the ones about the dinosaurs. It's been a while. I've been out of the library for almost 9 years, so it's been a while.
Oh, okay.
The one book that they objected to And it's because I ordered it in Spanish. And I ordered it in Spanish because the library that I was at, we had a large population of Hispanic immigrants who were English as a second language, but they were all being tutored in English. And in fact, many of their parents came to night classes to learn English. And it was an Anne Rice book. It was Interview with the Vampire, and I brought it in.
Oh, I loved that book.
And I brought it in under the Spanish version because I had so many kids requesting it. And the parents didn't object to it because it was Interview with the Vampire or because it was Anne Rice. They objected to it because I ordered it in Spanish.
So, were they saying that, you know, these kids are here to learn English, they should learn English and read the English version, or?
I think that was part of it at that time, even though it probably, you know, 95% of the books, especially the fiction books, not necessarily the nonfiction, we did have an entire Spanish edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, but we had, you know what, we had six volumes of various kinds of encyclopedias. We had a high-low encyclopedia so that the students who had a low reading level but high interest could do their research in an encyclopedia. And I just thought it would be a good idea because we had, I wouldn't consider it a majority of English as a second language students, but we had enough that I felt that they needed to have a good Spanish version of the World Book Encyclopedia. And so we did. And no one objected to that. I don't know, maybe because it was reference material. But,
yeah, I could see them saying, you know, if the kids are here and they're trying to learn English, that's fine. But at the same time, they have to do social studies papers. They,
mm-hmm.
you know, they need to have resources they can use while they're still working on learning English.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
Do you speak Spanish or do you have background with Spanish?
My Spanish, even for having grown up here in Southern California and having in-laws who are Hispanic, my Spanish is strictly survival. I can say agua for water, and I can say los baños for bathroom. You know,
I noticed that in Ghost of a Chance, you did have several characters who referred to the fact that they could read and write Spanish, or they could speak Spanish, but they didn't really do it.
Yeah, right.
Out of deference to the main character, who I understand didn't speak Spanish.
Right. Shannon Delaney is from Chicago, and she does not speak Spanish. But Rosario Santiago is Mexican, and she speaks Spanish. She does make a point of saying that she speaks Castilian Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And then Francisco Zavala, who is a retired detective out of San Diego, he speaks Spanish as well. Later on, I think in book two, I make a small reference to Zach Zavala, Francisco's grandson, of speaking some Spanish. And, you know, that's not really all that unusual out here. I know that among my Mexican in-laws that unless they have taken Spanish in school, and most of them do, they don't learn correct Spanish, you know, just on the street. You learn a totally different form of Spanish. And Rosario makes a reference to that. But as far as speaking Spanish, no, I don't speak Spanish. I rely on a digital interpreter to take English into Spanish. And I rely on an English-Spanish-Spanish-English dictionary. And I also have one for French-English-English-French. Since we use a lot of French in our day-to-day lives in the English language, you know, like resume and soup du jour. We use them so often that we don't hardly even remember that they're French.
Mm-hmm. I studied French in high school, and I found that I used it a lot when I started reading Agatha Christie stories because I was very fond of the Poirot mystery.
Yes.
And he would often drop into French when he got excited.
Yes, and yet wasn't he Belgian? Wasn't he from Belgium?
And everybody kept calling him French, and he would keep correcting them.
Yes.
But he did speak French, and it was funny the number of times I read it, and I would just read along what he was saying and not realize that he had changed to a different language.
Oh,
yes. He just got so used to it.
I can do that a little bit with Spanish. I could probably read Spanish more than I can pronounce it. Mm-hmm. So much so that when I was, I cook a lot of Hispanic food, and I make tamales. And I needed to get masa, and masa is that cornmeal mix that is the basis for the tamale wrap, the tamale outside. And it's different from the ordinary cornmeal that you buy in grocery stores, and I wanted to go into basically the Mexican barrio section of San Bernardino to get it. And my sister-in-law said, okay, I'm going to call and make the arrangements. All you need to do is go over there and just tell them your name, and they will hand it to you.
Well, that was nice.
That was nice. And I said, okay, and how much is this? And she told me. And so I just went over there. It was like this, you know, undercover, covert action to go buy masa at a Mexican restaurant where I don't speak Spanish.
Anyway. Yeah. Can imagine.
But anyway, anyone who lives in California, I think especially Southern California, you get used to seeing Spanish here and there the way that you get used to seeing French if you're in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, and that makes sense. Now, since you brought up the food, I did mean to ask you, when you were talking about your father being a chef,
mm-hmm.
did his influence, is this where you got the emphasis on food in this? Because I did notice that when I was reading, like every time they talked about, well, okay, this has been really fun meeting and talking about, you know, digging around in this mystery, let's all go look some more and then we'll get together tomorrow. And then there was this discussion of what kind of food they would have.
Yes.
And I thought that was great. It was like, this is how real people talk.
Yes, it is.
You know, and so often people just skip over that and just stick to the facts of the plot, but it made it feel more like I was right there in the room with everyone. Because they're all talking about, okay, well, who's going to get dinner tomorrow?
Yeah. Thank you for that. And yes, that was definitely an influence from my father. One of the critical lessons that I learned from my father, and traveling with my father, is that there are two key elements to any culture. And culture can be described by a race. It can be described by the church that you go to, your ethnic culture, you know, whatever that culture is. The two very key telltale elements are food, the way the food is grown, harvested, and offered as hospitality. And then the other one is funerals, the way that we care for and honor the dearly departed is a very key telltale clue to a culture. And food is often very much part of all of our life mark celebrations, whether it's a birth, a birthday, a wedding, a funeral, whatever. Food is always there, you know, and this probably goes back to my Anglican Catholic roots of, you know, that of breaking of the bread and celebrating in Mass that we are a family of people, regardless of our backgrounds, regardless of what language we speak, regardless of our experiences, we all share a very, very common thread. Sometimes that thread is a blood memory, such as your culture and your ancestors, and other times that thread is one that you choose. And whatever that is, it's still a thread that binds us, and food is very critical to that. And so when I would, you know, travel with my father, whether we were eating, you know, at a grand hotel in Nassau, or we were kind of picnicking on a beach, it was the food that kind of brought people together. And that food became sort of a symbol of hospitality. It isn't so much what the food is, you know, I mean, whether it's, you know, sitting with a young child and sharing a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, or you're eating a five-course meal on linen with china and crystal, it really is the ambience of the hospitality and what is being shared. And so that essence of you know, having them sit and break bread and bringing these people from various backgrounds together to unite in solving this mystery and to share that experience in the ambience of sharing the hospitality of food was a critical factor to me. Mm. You know, there's to me there's a certain spirituality to it.
Yeah, it is. It's a very important part of every culture, really.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, it varies from culture to culture, how we handle our food and how we treat it and how
mm-hmm.
we prepare it. But that's a really interesting point to bring up, because it is, for every culture, it's very important.
It is, you know, and I mean, I can remember, you know, when we would travel and I didn't know what I was going to eat. And sometimes as a child, you don't necessarily care so much. It's just the experience of being with these new people, whether I was on a plantation in Eleuthera Island of the Grand Bahamas, and, you know, we were eating a different kind of tamales. It was tamales made with banana skins instead of corn husks.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Just the whole aspect that the food represents something that is very unique to that culture, and they've harvested it, they prepared it, and they have invited you into the hospitality of sharing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so food is, I guess, it's always had that sort of spiritual meaning to me. You know, I don't necessarily feel that way when I get up in the morning and I pull off my first cup of coffee.
Oh, there's a certain spiritual aspect to that, yeah.
There is, yeah. You know, and I think if people can look at a culture through the food that they eat, because honestly, I have never experienced any kind of food from any culture that I couldn't find something in it that I didn't like. And I think if you approach a culture from that point of view, you're going to be more open to understanding and appreciating that culture, whether they have great differences with your own culture or whether they have kindred, you know, likeness to your own culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to get that across to, you know, to other people, to, you know, how can you say that you don't like that culture, make such a gross generalized statement when you love that food?
Yeah. Well, that's really good. It's like the old saying, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach.
Book, yes.
And it works with everyone.
It does work with everyone. And food does touch upon every life mark that we experience.
Mm-hmm.
And often I have found, I have this fascinating book that's from the California State, it's an official foundation of, basically it's undertakers. If you want to study to be a mortician and you end up as a professional mortician, you would belong to this association. And they produced this book, and it tells you about the differences of all different kinds of funeral rites for many different cultures, religions, and denominations within those cultures and religions. And it's absolutely fascinating. You know, I mean, within, you know, just with, well, I'm going to use one that's sort of close to me because I've explained it most of my life. I am what is referred to in Europe as Anglican Catholic, but out here it would be Episcopal.
Oh,
and
okay.
Episcopalians celebrate the Mass very much like Roman Catholics do. In fact, I've invited many a Roman Catholic to Mass with me, and they essentially don't know the difference. But there are very key differences within the category of Catholicism with a capital C. Out here in California, because of the history of it being founded by Spanish conquistadors, people tend to say Catholic, and they mean Roman Catholic. But actually, you will find Anglican Catholic, Episcopal. You'll find a little-known denomination called Old Holy Catholic out here, as well as some of the Eastern Orthodox religions, which are sometimes in very archaic terms referred to as Catholic. But in this book of different funeral rites, it goes through all the very particular sanctions for all of the denominations, and even like little subcategories of those denominations. And
yep. Is this something that you might draw on more in future books that you might actually
I probably will.
Yeah. I have to be so careful what I say about your current book because
I know
our listeners haven't read it, and it's a mystery, and I don't want to give anything away.
Yeah.
But I did read it, honestly.
Yes.
I'm just being very careful about what to say about it. I know there were mentions of funerals.
Yeah.
But there wasn't very intensive description of the ceremony, and I just wondered whether you might consider doing that more in the future. It sounds like we've got a great resource there.
Yeah, I might. It probably won't be with the second book.
Yeah,
but with
if it has something to do with the plot, and that would be
if it has something to do with the plot. When I was in high school, a very, very good friend of mine who was named Tatiana, and that's a wonderful name for a person who is a gypsy, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And she was Romani, which is really the proper term because they were out of Eastern Europe, and I can remember her telling me about very specific do's and don'ts for a funeral that she was going to go to of a person who was important to the Romanis that she belonged to. And that's one of the more difficult cultures in America to find out any information with. Last year I had the opportunity to work in the sense that I communicated with him, a wonderful man named Matt Salo of the Gypsy Lore Society, because I was helping a person do some genealogy, and their mother turned out to be a gypsy, and that term was actually on the death certificate. And that surprised me, because it also said she came from Romania. But this was in the 1930s, and in the 1930s, they referred to a gypsy as a gypsy. They didn't try to refer to them as Romani. I think they just simply didn't know any better. But
well, maybe at that time it wasn't considered a derogatory term. I think it became
You know
that.
What? I would have to say, I agree with you 100%. If you look back at some of the novels in the 20s and 30s and some of the old films, the term gypsy was a very romantic sort of way of describing someone.
Mm-hmm.
It really was not derogatory. You know,
At
least I would say literature.
I think today, even, a lot of people don't see it as a derogatory term, but it certainly was for a while.
Yes, for a while it was, you know. And, you know, gosh, I don't even know how we got to talking about gypsies other than
I don't know.
Right?
This is how I love doing the show. We just kind of drift, you know. We talk about, I don't know.
But anyway, I had a friend in high school, and she was a Romani. Her family was out of Eastern Europe, what we would have called Russia. And she was just very, very fascinating to me, and I enjoyed being around her family. And then,
were they very much into the paranormal as well? Because that's sort of a historical thing about gypsies, is that they grew up with this culture of accepting psychic abilities, and they're very matter-of-fact about, say, fortune-telling.
Both of her parents were very well educated. One of them was a professor at the University of California at Riverside, and the other one was a music teacher, I think, at either the junior college or a high school nearby. It wasn't the high school that I went to.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I would say that at that time the term was superstitious. I didn't think of it that way, but then again, I'm Celtic.
Yeah.
In my beliefs, and yes, I think they did have a very strong sense of, I guess at that time we would have called it a sixth sense,
mm-hmm.
or a spiritual sense is what I would call it in the Celtic culture.
Yeah,
having
second
a very
sight is the Celtic phrase as well.
Yes, uh-huh. So yeah, yes they were. And, you know, that may have been something that made me feel so very comfortable in their home, quite possibly. And they were happy, and they were very musical. And because I'm tone deaf, I've always admired people who are musical. I always go to the long mass on Sundays, which is the 10 o'clock mass. It's almost 2 hours. And I go because that's when there's a lot of choir and hymns.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't sing, But our particular church does do a lot of the really old Irish and Scottish hymns from the 1700s, and they just have that different, I don't know, kind of melody to them.
Yeah, there's a very distinctive sound. It's hard to describe, but it's once you hear it.
Yes. Once you hear it, it kind of stays with you if it's something that you like. And we also have a bagpipe come in every now and then.
Oh, wow.
And that's to give tribute because the Episcopalian Church in America was founded on Scottish roots. So, and there again, we have gotten completely...
We're sort of, you know, weaving in and out. We're still staying with the whole paranormal thing because now we're talking about the Celtic background and the psychic side of that, which you did draw into your book a bit.
Yes, I did, because Shannon Delaney, I don't know if I say much about in this book about she is of Irish ancestry. In the second book, she kind of goes into it a little bit more, and I think she'll be discovering more and more about that as time goes on. But
she did seem to get information in ways that were not conventional. And I was wondering how much of that was because of her Irish background.
Oh, I think if people will stick with this series, they will find that all of it is because of her Irish background. Not every character, but on Shannon, on the Blackthorne family, because their family is very much involved, and then on the Zavala family, I actually did family trees for these characters.
Oh, wow.
And, well, you know, that comes into being a member of the DAR and doing my own family trees. And Shannon's family tree looks remarkably like my own.
Well, that makes sense.
I know. But yeah, and I've talked about this with a good friend of mine that I grew up with. She's Irish too. Her name is Linda McCulley, and she just got a copy of the book too, about the same day that you did. And she asked me, she said, "Well, is there anything in there that kind of relates to, you know?" She calls it Irish superstition, but that's what she grew up with. And she'll say, "Is there anything in there that relates to Irish superstition?" And I will answer her and say, there's a lot in there that relates to our Irish spirituality and our intuitive sense about there being more in nature, more on heaven and earth than what we can see or touch, and how if we just open ourselves up to it, it will speak to us. A couple of years ago, when I was talking about doing this, my sister, who has now passed on, her name was Mary Bridget Martinez. I should say Mary Bridget Egan Martinez. And so that really speaks volumes about how the Irish and the California Hispanics intermarried. And she said, "Why are you so driven to do this?" And I said, "Mary Bridget, it's because I listen to the whispers of our ancestors and I write from blood memory."
Wow.
And I do believe that that's true. I think just like we inherit the color of our eyes, you know, maybe something in our physical stature. I have a very thick head of dark hair that's going gray, but I know I owe that to my Irish and Scottish ancestors. I think we also inherit something else in our genes and in our DNA, and it is that sense of intuitive spirituality. And if we listen, their voices, we will hear.
Wow.
And so I guess in that sense, it would be paranormal. I just never thought of it that way.
Yeah, that can lead us right back into a whole discussion of what is paranormal, what constitutes paranormal. Like we started to talk about a little bit at the beginning of the show, and I'd love to get back into that.
Okay.
Actually, right now we need to go to a break.
Okay.
So why don't we take a bit of a break now, and we will pick up with the whole discussion of what is paranormal when we come back. So for those of you who, if anyone's just joining us now, you're listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and also on UPRN 105.8 FM in New Orleans. We're going to take a break for a few minutes, go grab a glass of water, something to drink, come on back. When we return, I'll be talking again with Elizabeth Egan Cox about her new book, A Ghost of a Chance, which I thought was being released next week, but it's out. So go grab a copy. It's really a fun read. Terrific paranormal mystery. And thanks, everyone. We'll be right back. Hi, everyone. We're back, and you're listening to Through the Keyhole on Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.8 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest this week is Elizabeth Egan Cox, who has written a paranormal novel called Ghost of a Chance, which I had the opportunity to read early. She was kind enough to send me a review copy, and it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it, and I highly recommend that you go to, which was the website that you gave us just tonight, Elizabeth, with MobiPocket.com?
Yes, MobiPocket.com.
M-O-B-I Pocket.com. And
yes.
It's on our, the Pal Talk site, on our instant messaging. I had put the other site, eBooks on the Net, on my website, along with your bio. Now, can people still get it through the eBooks on the Net?
Ebooks on the .net is the actual publisher, so
uh-huh.
Yes, it's just that the publisher is not bringing it out until August 1st.
Okay.
However, if they go to ebooks on the .net and contact the publisher, I'm sure the publisher would send them an email when it came out.
Okay. It was a fantastic book, and during the first half, we were talking a little bit about the story, and we came around just at break time to talking about what the concept of paranormal actually means. We were talking about being Irish and intuitive, which your main character, Shannon Delaney, is. And that brings me to another question I wanted to ask you before we get into the discussion of paranormal, is how many books have you written? Was this the first in this series?
This is the first book in this series. All of the other books that I have worked on were nonfiction books, and they were a project, and so I don't make a reference to them. These were the kind of what used to be called coffee table books, big hardback books, lots of photos in them. They dealt with regional history and corporate histories, and I did that for a company that is now defunct. It was called Heritage Publishing.
Okay.
And then I also, I was actually a business writer. I wrote many, many corporate histories, and that's in the bio at the end of the book, for some of California's, actually some of America's most prestigious companies. Everything from cement manufacturing to women's fashion, such as Fashion 21, extreme sports like Billabong USA. Anyway, a lot of those corporations were my clients, and I wrote, it's sort of a soft form of publicity by writing a corporate history.
Okay, I was just about to ask what exactly is a corporate history, but it's just that, it's a story of the company.
Yeah,
it's
the story of the company.
Okay.
And this all kind of came about because of websites. Corporations were developing websites. They needed to have something on there about them as a corporation. And then they would put out brochures. And a lot of the corporations here in Southern California have wonderful archives. There was one bank, PFF Bank and Trust. They held the very first mortgage on the home of Walter and Cordelia Knott. Now, on the East Coast, the word Knott, K-N-O-T-T, may not mean much, but once you pass the Mississippi, the word Knott stands for Knott's Berry Farm, one of the most famous amusement parks in California. And, of course, the Knott's Jam and Jelly Line.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so they had a wonderful archive, you know, that I could get into. I've written for school districts. You know, they have incredible archives. I wrote for the Los Angeles County Fair, which is the second largest fair in the United States. And they began as a railroad carnival. You know, it's kind of hard to believe that a huge county fair would have begun as a railroad carnival. You know, it's just amazing that getting to know these corporations and working very closely with them on publicity that presents a corporate history that allows, you know, the neighborhood, the region to know what they're about.
Mm-hmm. So how did you move from writing corporate histories to writing essentially a ghost story with a mystery in it? Well, actually, all ghost stories have a mystery, because when you want to find out who the ghost is and what's going on, there's always, obviously, there's always a death involved, and people try to find out who is this and who died and why are they haunting?
Well, during one, I think, summer, when I had a little bit of time, I decided to write fiction. And I wrote four pieces of short fiction. All of them were based in what would be considered paranormal, except one, which was a sort of a psychological terror crime. And I experimented with the four different genres to find out which one I really liked. This story, the book, A Ghost of a Chance, was based on a very short piece of fiction called Thin Air. And I sold that to a British magazine. And I kind of put it aside. And then in 2006, I decided that I was going to sort of retire, so to speak, in the sense that the old California Gazette, which I wrote a column for, and it was based on history, was going out of business. I'd been a columnist before for other magazines, and I really didn't want to be tied down to writing a column. I used to write a weekly column for a now-defunct website called RadioDigest.com.
And did you write on anything... Not on ghosts or on topics or anything?
No.
Oh, wow.
No.
So this is a really new direction for you, then.
Well, in a way, it was. I love Victorian architecture. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, I was writing about California history. So I was going around to all of these various historical sites. And because I wrote for this magazine, I had the edge. I could get into places that normally you couldn't get into. It was basically a media pass. And you begin to get feelings about old places, whether they're old cemeteries or old jails, you know, old homes or whatever. You do begin to get feelings about them, and I've always had that intuitive sense anyway. And I just thought, you know what, I'm going to kind of go back to my roots and write about how thin the veil is between this world and the one before us. Now, other people who don't have maybe the roots in history that I do, mm-hmm. maybe would write about how thin the veil is between this world and the one to come. Okay?
Yeah.
Actually, I have a clan cousin named Greg Egan in Australia, and he writes science fiction that's about alternative worlds.
Oh, wow.
That's not my style. I you know, everything I do is relative to an appreciation for the people who came before us, you know, their history and our evolution, or in some cases, places maybe we didn't evolve to.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of seemed natural. The story, in a way, almost wrote itself. I know at break time, you and I were talking a little bit about this, and I was explaining how I kind of dream write. I sort of come up with a basic plot, and I go from chapter to chapter. I stop about every three chapters, and I summarize. And then I'm not quite sure about where to go next. I may have two or three different directions, and so I tell myself I'm going to sleep on it. And then I do, and I get up the next morning, and I basically wrote it in my dream. And I kind of put that in part of the story on page 158. Shannon is going back over the dreams that she's had, and she recalls a dream where a character said to her, dreams are answers to questions we have yet to ask. And that's kind of how I've lived my life.
Wow.
That my dreams do end up being the answers to questions that have not become very apparent. But when they do become apparent, I know which path to take because of what came to me in a dream.
In Shannon's case, when the question presented itself, she knew which way to go, and she recognized it because she saw the answer.
Yes.
Which she had already come across.
Yes.
That was really neat. I loved the way that worked out in the story, and it's hard for me to say more without giving away part of the mystery, so
I want
to be very careful about that. But
yeah, I have to be careful about it, too. And I think that it was that part of my own beliefs about having an intuitive sense about the right paths that we can take in our lives was it really kind of wrote that section of the book, or that segment in the book.
And it kind of brings us back to what we were saying when we went to break. You were talking about this intuitive sense, this using your intuition, and that maybe some people would call that paranormal. And you're about to talk again about what the term paranormal actually means, because it is kind of, it's used a lot these days. I mean, even we're broadcasting on the Paranormal Radio Network. So, you know, what exactly, Miss Reference Librarian, what exactly does paranormal mean?
Well, I think from a reference librarian point of view, and although I've never looked it up in a dictionary, I think it probably gives a very brief definition, something like, paranormal is used to describe things, experiences, or happenings, or beliefs that we cannot explain with scientific fact.
Mm-hmm.
But you notice I did not put in there, it doesn't mean that it's not true.
Right.
You know.
It's anything that falls outside of what's considered to be normal, you know, beyond normal or outside the normal. So I guess what's considered paranormal sort of depends on what you consider to be normal to begin with.
I guess so. But yeah, honestly, I would object to the use of normal in there only in the sense that I don't think of it as being not normal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I think my intuitive sense, for instance, when we go out looking for real estate, and we haven't moved very much, my husband and I, in our 30 years of marriage, we've owned two homes. But we, you know, like everyone, you look and look and look because you want to make sure you get the right home. And I cannot explain why I do this, but whenever I go up to a piece of real estate, whether it's a historic home that I've gone into tour, I take my right hand and I place it, as I'm facing the front door, I place it on the right side of the door frame. And if I get a bad feeling about it, I won't go inside that building.
Well, that makes sense.
Okay. I mean, most people would say, well, why aren't you using your left hand? That's the one that's on the side of your heart. Well, I don't know. Maybe I use my right hand because I am right-handed, you know. And maybe that's where more of my strength lies when it comes to detection, whether it's detection of something that is physical that can be felt, or detection of something that is not physical but can still be sensed. So is that paranormal to someone else? Perhaps so. But for me, that is not outside the normal. But I know what you're saying, especially having been a librarian. I think the term paranormal to describe a category is almost too broad.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look back over the evolution of our culture using terms to describe categories, it always starts off broad and then it becomes more refined as we go on and as that category is accepted more and more into mainstream. You know, at the beginning of this interview, I kind of mentioned an old book and an old TV series that was called The Ghost and Mrs. Muir.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was a great one, and there was a ghost in
it. Yeah, that was terrific.
Uh-huh.
Wow, I haven't thought about it in years.
Yeah. And for people who are older than me, and by the way, I'm 56, I use that as a frame of reference to try and describe to them what my book is like. But for people my age or younger who watch TV, I tell them, if you like The Ghost Whisperer, you will like my book. Well, you see, that whole aspect of someone being able to sense, communicate, or relate to ghosts as a frame of reference has now come back into the mainstream.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much in the mainstream right now. The TV shows Paranormal State.
Right. Oh, there you go. Exactly, Paranormal State. It's very much, I mean, for goodness sakes, I don't know what others watch it on, but here it's on the Arts and Entertainment Network.
Yeah, it is here too.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there you see. Now it's back more into the mainstream. I can remember as a teenager in Riverside, and Riverside has a really famous hotel called the Mission Inn Hotel. And there's some wonderful Victorian architecture in Riverside. And there was this one home that was supposed to be haunted. And I've been inside the home, and I think it is haunted. But at one time, the word haunted meant something evil. I think now haunted doesn't necessarily mean something evil. You know, I mean, again, we still sort of use that to say she was haunted by bad dreams. But we could also say she was haunted by good dreams, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I think probably still has a negative connotation.
I would agree. And honestly, I have used it more
to it.
As a negative connotation.
Yeah, but to say a house is haunted is not necessarily a bad thing anymore. People talk it like about it as if they're proud of it.
Oh,
and
my
in
God.
In fact, I was trying to book some travel online today, and I was looking for a hotel. And when I did a search on a particular hotel in a certain town, I got all this long list of results, of course, on Google. One of the topics was haunted hotels.
Yes.
And I thought, holy cow, people advertise now. Come stay in my haunted hotel. And it used to be this thing like hotel owners would never, ever want people to think that their place was haunted because they'd never get any business again.
Yes. And you know, when we travel, one of the things that we try to do is to take a ghost tour. Or it's usually a walking tour,
mm-hmm.
You know, a ghost tour of New Orleans. It doesn't get much better than that.
Oh, absolutely. I would love to do that.
A ghost tour of historic Richmond or a ghost tour of Colonial Williamsburg.
Yeah.
This Halloween, we'll be taking a ghost tour of Vicksburg, Mississippi. You know, so I think in some cultures, it has always been there. Certainly in the Celtic culture, it has always been there, and ghost was not a scary word. We would call it a spirit visitation, and I guess that would be considered paranormal by some people.
Yeah.
But, you know, looking at the website for the Paranormal Radio Network, the one that you're on,
mm-hmm.
You've got many different programs that address different aspects, I guess, of what would be called paranormal, dealing with things that would be, I guess, futuristic or UFOs. In fact, it seems to me your program not too long ago was in Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, and then you get into things like crop circles, which I was doing kind of a lot ago because they seem to happen a lot in the UK, especially England, mm-hmm. and not so much in other places. And I had to wonder why.
Well, actually, I've just been looking into the crop circles a little bit. I belong to a local meetup group here in Rochester, and one of the things, it's a UFO meetup group, but the group wanted to talk about crop circles. And so my husband actually put together a presentation on crop circles.
Oh.
And he pointed out, after he did some research, that, yeah, they do usually take place in England, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some in several other countries. There have been some in this country, but we mm-hmm. don't hear about them.
But
and
you,
I thought that was fascinating. I want to look into it more.
Yeah. You see, I have to wonder when you consider the size of England, and I know that they're in Ireland and they're in Scotland, because my Irish clan cousins, we still have a castle in Ireland. And, you know, we have a chieftain. And two
wow.
years ago when we had an international reunion in Dallas, I was asking Chieftain Michael Egan about these kinds of things. But it does seem to be like there is a great deal of them in England, and England is such a tiny country when you consider, you know, the size of the U.S. or Canada or even France or Germany. So, you know, you kind of have to wonder. I'm very open to that kind of thing. But instead of, I'm just kind of probably more in toward the past. While you may go to a UFO meetup, I go to cemeteries, and I can't explain that. You know, that I can walk through cemeteries, and I will have very peaceful feelings in some areas, you know, as I walk through and read the gravestones, and then I will have very kind of violent or scary, you know, goosebumps kind of feelings about others. And the further back you go in looking at cemeteries and gravestones, the less information there is. You know, often it doesn't even give a month and a day. It'll just give, you know, like 1836 to 1905.
Yeah.
That is very little information. And then, of course, you come across your cities of the dead, like in New Orleans, and even less information because they're tombs. You know, they're standing tombs, so to speak. But what is paranormal? I think that's almost a very individual question.
Yeah, it's one of those words that's used so much nowadays that I think it's come to mean different things to different people.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I mean, technically, if one wanted to define it, I think it just refers to anything that doesn't have a scientific explanation. I mean, like in a dictionary, that's what it would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
nowadays,
I agree with you.
People like ghost hunters would say, well, this does have a scientific explanation. We go out with equipment and we measure these things.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be a bit of an argument there, too.
Well, but you know, when I see the word paranormal, I don't think that it makes a statement one way or the other about whether something is fact or non-fact.
Mm-hmm.
So when I see the word paranormal, I see it simply as a description of many other different categories of experiences.
But yeah, I guess that's how I think of it, as something outside everyday experience. And, you know, for me, it covers a huge
uh-huh.
range of topics. For example, as we were talking about, UFOs, crop circles,
mm-hmm.
hauntings, and all of these, to me, come under the heading of paranormal. To me, it's anything that we don't really understand yet.
But don't you think those are also almost like events? I mean, a crop circle to me would be almost an event.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, very definitely.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's something that happens, but then it raises the question of where did it come from? Who put it there? How did they do it?
Right.
What does it mean?
Right, and then the investigation goes
mm-hmm.
from there.
Speaking
I have
of crop
been
circles,
fascinated
you...
by that kind of activity.
It's yeah, did you hear about the recent crop circle just last month? It was in June. And someone finally figured out, an astrophysicist figured
mm-hmm.
out that it expressed the value of pi to something like 9 or 10.
Oh, okay.
Places.
I read something about that.
That is phenomenal.
It is.
I mean,
it is. You know, and so don't you wonder about that? Don't you wonder if maybe mathematics is the universal language?
It certainly seems like it is.
Uh-huh.
And then when you look at pyramids,
yes.
people have brought that all down to mathematical ratios, and equations can
mm-hmm.
be expressed in the size and shape of a building.
Mm-hmm.
That's just phenomenal to me.
Yeah, you know, so see, that's a category of paranormal, the one that really sort of has math or aspects of science, and I say aspects because I'm not a science person, so I can't really speak intelligently about it, other than I do know something about DNA because I'm involved in that with family tree DNA. But, you know, other aspects of like the engineering factor, how the pyramids were built, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. It's similar to the crop circles, and we don't know how they're built either.
You know,
I mean, they're obviously using different technology from each other, but we can't figure out either one of them.
You know, and I mean, I can remember when I was a teenager, because we traveled in the area, the Bermuda Triangle was a huge focus at that time. You know, and, you know, that's something else you kind of have to wonder about. I know
exactly.
I've gone over many, many old maps because of studying California history and the conquistadors and that, and there's never any mention about it, but it will show, it'll show like some turbulent waves and a ship sinking, but there's no mention about it as the Devil's Area or the Devil's whatever or Davy Jones' Locker or anything like that.
Yeah.
So,
well, there's always that suspicion that if you name something, you give it power.
That's true. That's
so
true.
Maybe that was a way of giving other sailors a warning without actually.
Yeah. I think science will end up proving a lot of beliefs that some people classify as fantasy or fantastic. I think science will end up proving a lot of those have a very sound foundation for having been real and may continue to be real. I have a sort of a friend whose daughter, who is like, well, she would be like the age of a daughter if I had one, who is a scientist. And we often talk about religious aspects. And she firmly believes that science will eventually prove a lot of the things that were in biblical writings to actually have happened. You know, and I've always kind of thought that's sort of a very interesting aspect from a young person who is, you know, who has a master's degree in her chosen field of science, and she really feels that science is eventually going to bring aspects of religion closer rather than pushing it apart, you know, because of the ancient world having an actual foundation for having existed and certain events may actually have happened that are considered either religious fantasy or even maybe ancient mythology. Yeah.
That's really interesting that she feels that way, and I have to say I believe that it certainly could happen, and probably the biggest reason it hasn't is that so many people who are interested in science and have a scientific outlook on life are just simply not willing to look at things that are classed as paranormal.
Oh, I agree with you. I have met more people who are science-focused, you know, or they are science related in their profession, and that's where their degrees are and everything, and they don't have a sense of spirituality, they don't have a sense of religion, they don't have a sense of mythology, they don't have a sense of being open to the fact that there are more things on heaven and earth, Horatio, to quote Shakespeare,
exactly,
you know, than what anyone will ever actually be able to explain. So don't close your mind to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of my philosophy. If you can't absolutely disprove it, you know, I mean, I can disprove to you that my hair is not blonde. My hair is dark with gray. And so I will argue that based on factual evidence that I can provide. But anything else, I'm not going to argue, because I do believe that there are more things on heaven and earth, Horatio, that, you know, that we shouldn't just be naysayers about. We should stay open to.
Yeah.
We should have a healthy sense of being a skeptic, but I think we also need to have a healthy sense of being open. You know, so for every person who believes that something could have happened from a supernatural experience, there should be a person there who can go through the numbers, who can go through the science of it and say, well, okay, it didn't happen that way. So maybe what you really had was a supernatural. And you know what? Bringing up the word supernatural, to me, that's what paranormal is, or at least that's really what the focus of my book would have been called until paranormal became the title for the broad category.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, does no one use the word supernatural anymore?
I don't know. Until you brought it up, that just reminded me that, no, I haven't heard that word in a very long time. Only in some of the older books that
mm-hmm.
I find, they do mention it. But no, the new word appears to be paranormal. You know, people
yeah.
really don't.
Well,
and
maybe
I'm just looking this up
experience.
Online while we're talking, and that just means being above or beyond what is considered to be natural.
Something
yeah,
I kind of like that better.
Natural law. So, yeah. Now, I remember reading a book on demonology by Ed and Lorraine Warren. It's an older book, and I don't recall when it was written, but I found it a good 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe it was new at that time. And someone said to Lorraine Warren something about, so this occurrence is supernatural, and she said, no, it's preternatural. And I thought, holy cow, now we got another word in the mix here, and I didn't know what that meant either.
Yeah, I think Anne Rice used that word for a description
yeah.
in one of her books, and then maybe stopped using it, because it is sort of a word that people may kind of scratch their head at.
Yeah. I got the impression, and I may entirely be incorrect on this, but I got the impression that the Warrens used preternatural to refer to what anyone else would call supernatural activity, but if it was caused by demons.
Oh, okay.
So it had this evil connotation to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, okay. I never thought of it that way. To me, the supernatural was something that was above the natural world that I am. But it doesn't mean that it's out of bounds or it's out of reach,
mm-hmm.
you know. Of course, we're getting back then to my whole Celtic culture in the sense that there are indeed times that the veil is very thin. Because after all, time is something that man created. You know, I mean, we sort of create the whole aspect of measuring time. And
the whole concept of linear time is really,
uh-huh.
it's not objectively real. It's something we all agreed to because that enables us to
yes.
have lunch at the same time in the same place.
Exactly.
But
do you know at one time it was going to be a 13-month calendar?
I'm sorry?
At one time, I think this was around, it was right after, right before World War II, a League of Nations met and they wanted to create a 13-month calendar.
Oh, well, that would make sense.
Because of the whole leap year thing. And so that kind of tells you how we feel like we should be able to manipulate those things that are really more of an essence
mm-hmm.
than they are tangible. And we live in a world that isn't always tangible. When we go to sleep, you know, what's going on inside of our brain is not necessarily tangible, although it can be impacted by the tangible. I can certainly, you know, tell you that when I woke up the other night during an earthquake.
Oh, I cannot even imagine what that is. You know what? I love California, and I keep thinking I would love to move to California
uh-huh.
if I were ever to move someplace. Only I would just be absolutely terrified of the earthquake, I think,
well,
because I've never dealt with it.
I live right on top of the San Andreas Fault. I don't
oh
mean
my
near
gosh.
It. I mean, I live right on top of the North Branch of the San Andreas Fault. It was earthquakes that created the mountains I live in. The mountains in California were not created from volcanoes like elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
These were created because the two plates came together and one won and one pushed the other up. And so that's what the mountains are where I live. And
oh, wow.
the problem with earthquakes, I've lived through tornadoes, earthquakes, and hurricanes. The problem with earthquakes is that you cannot prepare for them. You can only prepare for the aftermath.
Yeah.
So, you know, whereas with a tornado or a hurricane, you get the warning ahead of time and you can prepare, you can evacuate. You cannot evacuate from an earthquake.
Well, what about animals? I seem to remember some indications that animals sometimes know when an earthquake is coming.
Yes. Not all of my animals have. You know, in this story I mentioned an Irish wolfhound, and it's because I've had Irish wolfhounds. I had them for 20 years. But I also had a Russian wolfhound, and for those out there who don't know what a Russian wolfhound is. They're technically called a borzoi, and they look like an anorexic collie.
Oh.
Okay, they are the original Art Deco dog that you would see with fashion models.
Oh, okay.
And my
borzoi, made it very clear.
Yeah, was named Nadia. Good Russian name for a beautiful dog, beautiful person that she was. And she was a person. I think animals are kind of people-like.
Yeah.
And she always knew when an earthquake was going to happen because she would wake me up and it's like, we got to get out. Let's get outside. Let's get out of the house. But, you know, and sometimes I would get out in time. Other times I would just stand in the doorway because that is probably the safest place during an earthquake. And so some animals seem to have a sense of it and others don't. You know, and, you know, there again, that's something that could be considered supernatural too. I've always trusted my dogs. I've had dogs and cats. And I've always trusted my dog's sort of sixth sense about people. If we're out walking and my dog does not like someone, I immediately put my guard up.
That's really smart.
I just feel that dog knows a whole lot more about that person than I do.
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, I think it's fascinating learning about what other senses animals have that we don't. And I'm not talking about anything paranormal or supernatural or whatever word we want to use for it. They simply have far more sensitive senses than we do.
They do.
They have hundreds of thousands of scent receptors.
Yes.
Which is a ridiculous number compared to what we have. You know, it's as if we walk around with no noses at all compared to them.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
In fact, I read an article about a dog that was trained to diagnose cancer.
Yes.
There was a doctor who was able to take cell samples and put them down in front of this dog, and he could give them a whole row of them off, like, one patient from different parts of their body, and the dog would go straight to one that had cancer cells in it.
Yeah,
but it was so
I had an experience like that with a cat that I had. My father died of skin cancer, and it runs in my family. My dermatologist said, well, you know, you're of Northern European ethnicity. What do you expect? And I had a small spot on my wrist, and it started to grow very quickly. I mean, like overnight you could feel it. And my cat would not leave it alone. I called my doctor, and I said, I need to have a dermatologist look at this. And she said, well, it's probably nothing. I said, you don't understand. My cat will not leave it alone. And right now I trust my cat's instinct more than I do yours.
Oh, I bet that went over well. Oh, my gosh. And what did the doctor say?
It was a form of
crazy. I have to get her in now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I went right in. You know, and I went right in. The dermatologist took it off. It was sort of a wart mole thing. And in 3 days, it grew to be like the size of a small green pea. So it was very disconcerting to me.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be, it was a form of skin cancer, but it was non-malignant.
Oh, good.
You know, but my cat was very insistent. And so I thought, that's it. My cat knows better.
Yeah. Yeah, they know.
They do know. They really do.
I had a cat come home from the vet injured once. And my other two cats just, you know, wouldn't have anything to do with him. And it was so strange to me because normally they sit together when one comes home from the vet. You know, he still had some healing to do. He'd been hit by a car. But they just, they'd hiss at him even.
Ooh.
And I called the vet back after a day or so, and I said, yeah, I don't know what's going on. He looks okay to me, but the other cats won't go near him, and they're hissing. And she said, bring him right back in. There's something going on.
Oh, yeah.
And it turned out he had an infection. He had a broken leg, and it was infected down inside. And they actually had to do surgery to clean it out. And there was no way that that she or I would have known about it. But the cats knew there was something wrong.
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, having animals around can maybe make us more sensitive to intuitive senses that we have or intuitive powers.
Really? I never thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was sort of like people who are intuitive like to have animals around. But it never occurred to me. I think having the animals can actually increase that sense in us.
I think so, sure, because they're in sense, they're a kindred spirit, you know. And now, maybe not everyone feels the way that I do. I have never picked my pets. I let my pets pick me. you know, I may have wanted a particular kind of pet, like I wanted Irish wolfhounds, but when I would get to the breeder, I would say, I'm going to let them pick me.
Uh-huh.
And it was the same thing with the dog that I have now, who's not an Irish wolfhound. I needed to downsize because it's really hard to get two Irish wolfhounds into a Jeep Wrangler. And so the dog I have now is exactly one half Lab and one half Shar Pei. But she picked me. You know, I said, I want the dog to pick me. It doesn't matter if it's male or female. And so I
do
consider dogs
if I go to a shelter,
and cats to be kindred spirits.
Yeah. Actually, I rarely get my pets even at shelters. They often, I have cats that just turn up.
Oh, see, I think...
Cats just appear.
Yeah, I've had cats adopt me,
mm-hmm.
and those have always turned out to be wonderful relationships. You know, it's a little bit different with dogs because I live in an area where this is not sunny Southern California. This is, you know, four seasons. We get deep snow. And so when it comes to dogs, I have to choose to get them in summer because it's really difficult to potty train a dog when you live in a three-story house.
Oh,
and there's snow on the ground.
Yeah. We have a big dog, too, and we went through the same thing. We got our Lab when she was still sort of a puppy, but she was almost full size.
Uh-huh.
And she was fully grown, I think, but not mature at all. She was a puppy in a great big body.
Yeah.
And we got her right after Christmas.
Yeah. Well, I think some dogs remain puppies, you know, in that sense. I had an Irish wolfhound who was just sort of a puppy his whole life, very intelligent. Very adult-like when he needed to be, but otherwise he just kind of had that happy-go-lucky, playful attitude that puppies have. You know,
I thought it was really nice that you had the Irish wolfhound in the book. I really enjoyed
Atlas.
Yeah.
Atlas kind of created himself, but he's very much based on my 20 years of experience of Irish wolfhounds. And then also I mentioned somebody who has Maine Coons, and I have a Maine Coon.
Oh, okay.
One of my cats is a Maine Coon.
Does he have that short tail?
No, they have
a
very long, full, boa-like tail.
Oh, okay.
Oh, and they know they have a tail.
Oh, I was thinking of Manx.
Huh?
I'm sorry, I'm thinking of the Manx cats that have the really
Maine
tiny
Coons
tails.
Are an Angora-type cat. They're the official cat of the state of Maine, and they're the oldest American breed of cat.
Wow.
Very large, and they're kind of playful, too, very laid-back. And they do like, they're called Maine Coons because they're raccoon-like with their paws. They will pick things up and play with them with their paws in a way that I've never seen any other cat do.
Neat.
You know, and if they can, they'll pick it up and kind of hold it. And if they could walk on two legs, they would probably carry it in their paws.
And there's the historian in you coming out again.
Yeah.
Hear that.
Yeah.
We are, unfortunately, just about out of time. Elizabeth, I've had a wonderful time talking with you this evening. I can't believe it's been 2 hours already.
Oh, my gosh. Time
flies by,
doesn't
it?
Yes, time flies.
So I have to say once again, I really enjoyed your book. I see there are some more people joining us now.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth Egan Cox's book is called A Ghost of a Chance, and it is now out. You can get it at www.mobipocket.com. You can also get it at www.ebooksonthe.net.
Yes.
And
yes.
You have another one that you're working on, you said.
It'll be the second book in this series. Yes.
And any idea when would that be out, like later this year or next spring? Or?
I would imagine within a year, probably at least by next year at this time, if not sooner.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, now I'm looking forward to the next one in the series.
Well, thank you. I will be here to contact you.
Well, thanks so much for joining me tonight, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Really
I really and truly have enjoyed this. And,
great.
I think I found a kindred spirit in you.
I think so.
Uh-huh.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And thanks to everyone for listening. This has been Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and UPRN 105.8 FM in New Orleans. If you didn't get to hear the whole show, archives are available at ParanormalRadioNetwork.com and on iTunes. I'm your host, Karen Dolan. I want to thank my guest, Elizabeth Egan Cox, one more time. And I want to mention to everyone, stay tuned for Portal, coming up next with Tuesday Miles and Angela Thomas. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.